The Devolutionist by Homer Eon Flint. Chapter 7. A World Becalmed. I think we have learned enough to form some general conclusions, said the doctor, after the four had told what each had heard and seen. Van Emmon's friend Powart seems to be anything but a democrat. He probably represents the most aristocratic element on the planet. While this man Fort, who rescued the girl, is also probably a member of the leisure class. On the other hand, we have Smith's agent, whose name we do not know. He seems to be one of the working class, which Powart despises. The two are at opposite ends of the social scale. Young Ernol, whose father is in trouble, appears to be a rising young revolutionist. But Mona, to give the name Powart gave his fiancée, Billy's surgeon, the girl whose life Fort saved, she is not so easy to classify. On the Earth, we would call her occupation a middle-class one. But that remark she made about people being cattle gives me the impression that she is an aristocrat at heart. I call her a mystery for the time being. As for the planet itself, of course, the people simply refer to it as the Earth, or some term which translates that way to us. We need a name for it. What shall we call her, this daughter of Capella's? Capellette, from Billy, promptly. Fine. The other two looked their approval. Now we are ready to analyze things. What shall we say of her people in general? Speaking for my surgeon, observed Billy, doesn't she argue a rather high degree of development? The others were plainly willing for the doctor to take the lead. He rubbed his knuckles harder than ever as he considered Billy's suggestion. A higher degree of development? Not easy to say. Safer to assume that the development is higher in spots, not in general. Perhaps we'll do well to consider other things first. Take those two clocks, for instance. The one that I saw had a pendulum of ordinary length, which vibrated twice as fast as that, indicating an astronomical clock at his side. What about the timepiece you saw, Van? 25-hour dial, and a pendulum of the usual length, same as yours. But it vibrated no faster than any I ever saw before. You're sure? At the emphatic nod, the doctor frowned. We are forced to conclude that Capellette is not as round as our Earth. No other way to account for such a difference in gravitation as the two clocks indicate. Roughly, I should say that the planet's diameter, at the place where I saw the clock, is 50% greater than at the point where Van's agent is located. Maybe 10,000 miles in its greatest diameter, Capellette. Having greater gravitation would explain why that disabled aircraft which Smith saw fell so very slowly. The planet has much more air than the Earth, which means far greater density near the surface. It also explains those big sailing cruisers. Nothing else can. At any rate, we can guess why we have seen no surface travel. The people of Capellette never tried to work out such a thing as an automobile. Why should they, with the birds to imitate, and extra dense air all about them? I think we have found the key. The doctor cogitated for a second or two. However, let's consider that schoolroom a bit. It was in no way different from what you will find on the Earth right now. Why? Smith had a notion. There is simply such a thing as perfection, like some electrical apparatus. You simply can't improve them. Sounds reasonable, from Van Emmon. Yes, and that is undoubtedly how the Capellettes look at the matter. Why haven't they got talking pictures? Because they've perfected the silent variety, of course. Why don't they reform their ways of living instead of replacing a worn-out heart with a new one? They've perfected surgery. That's why. And why haven't they tried the screw propeller? They've perfected the bird wing principle. But that doesn't explain, objected Billy, why they've been content with an autocratic system of government. Van Emmon considered this a dig at Powart. Why, of course their government is autocratic, my dear. How else can it be protective? You seem to have a lot of admiration for your Mr. Powart, laying her hand on his. I have. He and the others seem to be highly capable fellows who have undertaken to maintain happiness and have made good. But without the direct consent of the people. What of that? Warmly. Most folks don't care to burden their heads with lawmaking anyhow. They'd rather leave it up to specialists. Who are only too willing, my dear, to handle the matter at their own price. The doctor put in hastily. From what you tell me, Van, this commission determines the living conditions for the majority, although it has no popular authority whatever. Moreover, conditions are no better than they were 100 years ago. There's been no progress. Powart admits that. Now, placing that fact alongside the rest, I reach this conclusion, that the people of Capellette, no matter what may have been their experience in the past, do not now care for revolutionary ideas. They want standardization, not change. It all roots back in that extra-dense air of theirs. See why? Apparently the three did not. The doctor explained, Life is much easier for them than for us. It is no great struggle to gain a livelihood where transportation is so easy and simple. In consequence of this, their advancement was much more rapid than ours here on the earth, up to a certain point. And they've reached that point already. Coming back to that commission again, instead of trying out a democratic form of government, in which every citizen would be equally responsible regardless of property, they've standardized the protective, paternalistic principle. Which is precisely the correct method, insisted the geologist. Radical changes of any kind are always dangerous. The only safe method is to improve what we already have. Suppose, remarked Billy, suppose government becomes so thoroughly standardized that it can't be improved any further. Then it becomes permanent, if it isn't overthrown. The doctor smilingly interposed, Let me finish and get this out of my system. By their own confession, the Commission's chief function is to keep the majority in ignorance, which is said to be the same thing as bliss. This man Ernol and his pitiful rebellion only served to prove the rule. In a word, the Capellans have carried the principle of improvement as opposed to reform to its logical conclusion. They can go no further. And why not? Challenged Van Emmon. Because the fittest have survived on Capellette as elsewhere. These commissioners are the fittest. The doctor nodded gravely. True enough, Van. But the point I want to make is, the commissioners have put an end to the processes of evolution. They won't allow progress. They stopped all that a century ago. Friend, Capellette is a world that has given up. It has quit. Chapter 8. The Upper Crust. The next time Billy went into the teleconscious state, 48 hours later, she found that she had arrived in the midst of a conversation. It told her worlds. I answered the telephone, someone was saying, and Mr. Powart clearly said that he would be here within the hour. Footnote. The word hour is used advisedly. Of course, the Capellan hour may have an entirely different length from ours. I suppose it is just as well, answered the surgeon, whom Billy now knew as Mona. Yes, I dare say it is quite as well. Is there any reason why he shouldn't, dear? Inquired the other party, a middle-aged woman, magnificently dressed, of decidedly distinguished appearance. No, mother, replied the girl, not so far as he is concerned. But Mr. Fort is also coming today. The older woman saw nothing alarming about this.
I am glad to hear it. He impressed me as being a very nice boy, although rather impulsive.
You don't understand. It's going to be very embarrassing for me. Mr. Fort warned me last night, laughingly, of course, but I think he meant it, that he intended to propose today. Swift anxiety came to the mother's face. For a while she kept silence, and while Mona's conscious mind was occupied with thoughts that Billy could not fathom, her subconscious mind was faithfully taking in all that her roving eyes beheld. The two Capellans were seated upon the terrace of a large, handsome house, whose architecture Billy tentatively classified as semi-Moorish. Mona next glanced into the grounds, telling Billy that the house was set upon a knoll, high up on the ridge of a tremendous range of mountains. Similar houses dotted what landscape was visible through a mass of foliage. It was just the sort of residence colony that Billy herself would have chosen. Then the eyes came back to the mother, who was saying,
"Perhaps, my dear, you would rather that I told Mr. Fort of your engagement."
She watched the daughter, as though expecting her to refuse the offer. Which is just what the heart specialist did, with a proud toss of the head. "Thank you, but I cannot have him think that I lack the nerve to tell him myself." She excused herself and went into the house, passing through rooms so rapidly that Billy learned little, save that the place fairly swarmed with men in livery. Once in Mona's room, however, Billy discovered that metallic furniture was the rule, that the windows were without screens, and that the bed was set down very close to the floor. Otherwise, the room was much like any on the earth. Footnote: the Capellans seem to have utterly stamped out all forms of insect life except those directly beneficial to man. Mona's clothes interested Billy immensely. Without exception, the garments were skirtless, and a large proportion of the suits were in one piece. Headgear was limited to caps, of which Mona owned an immense variety, while she wore nothing but high lace-up boots or pumps. Billy was sure that all of these were of leather. With the aid of no less than four maids, all of whom were very pretty girls, Mona changed to a garment of some lustrous brown material, like silk velvet, but with a much longer nap, together with stockings of the golf pattern and black pumps. Next, she proceeded to inspect herself carefully in a mirror. Billy saw that Smith's estimate of not over 30 was accurate enough. The girl was still young as to face, although her body was remarkably robust. And Billy found that her delicacy of feature did not suffer from a close-up. Instead, her refinement was made only the more striking. Probably it was the high arching of her eyebrows that had made her face patrician. That, together with the sensitiveness of her nostrils. For there was nothing at all cold about her eyes. They were a very dark brown, large and full. And her lips were anything but haughty. They were a deep red and piquantly upturned at the corners. The whole carriage of her head, however, marked her as an aristocrat, but a lovable one. As she turned from the glass, the sound of a laugh came from the front of the house. Billy instantly recognized Fort's voice. Mona gave her hair a final touch and went straight to the terrace. "How do you do?" said the surgeon coolly, as she took Fort's eagerly outstretched hand. And again, Billy was more interested in the man's gray leather flying suit, so well becoming his fine muscular development, than in the conventional reply he made. Next moment, Mona's mother was saying,
"I have been trying to thank Mr. Fort for what he did yesterday. It was a remarkably brave thing."
"Indeed, it was," declared Mona with feeling. "And yet, try as I might last night, I was unable to make him see that it was anything out of the ordinary, Mother."
"Why, of course,"
protested the athlete carelessly. There was nothing brave about it. One is not brave unless one is afraid, and I wasn't afraid. I can take no credit for the thing.
Do you mean, questioned Mona, that you are never afraid?
Not when I am in the air.
There was silence for a minute, and again Billy used Mona's eyes to good advantage. Fort was certainly a good-looking chap, although slightly untidy in small items of his costume. He was the kind which looks best when somewhat disheveled, anyhow. As to face, a large, handsomely curved mouth, a slightly Roman nose, eyes as big as Mona's and as blue as hers were brown. Decidedly, the man was worth looking at again and again. Most daredevils are sharp-featured. Fort was kindly. There was something positively reassuring about his kind of audacity. Presently, the mother mentioned Ernol, the radical. Seemingly, these people had been privately informed of what Powart was keeping from the workers. Fort commented,
"I was really frightened when I heard of it. Why, if that fellow's philosophy is listened to, we all may have to work for a living."
His laughter rang above the rest. Then he thought of Mona.
"Oh, I say, I quite forgot, I assure you."
"Don't mention it," returned the surgeon humorously. "I don't mind telling you that this service of mine is largely camouflage. I belong to the delusion brigade." Fort was greatly surprised.
"You? A volunteer?"
"Quite so. There must always be someone of our class to whom people can look whenever they suspect that we are not quite democratic. Besides, I have always fancied surgery." She told briefly of her work.
"Why, you are a famous person," declared the athlete.
"You make me ashamed. I do nothing at all but amuse myself."
"Which is quite as well, Mr. Fort," the mother assured him. "I tried my best to keep Mona out of this. A social conquest is what I had planned for her. But she had set her mind on surgery, so—" And she left the rest to Fort's imagination. A moment later, Billy heard a flying machine approaching. Shortly it came near enough for her to see that it was greatly like a yacht, painted white all over, and possessing exceptionally tall masts. The canvas was already unfurled, and the vessel descending under the control of some unusually powerful wings.
"Mr. Powart's official boat," Mona explained to Fort.
The craft landed softly on the edge of the lawn, some distance away. The three on the terrace did not stir from their places as Powart, accompanied by 8 men in uniform, stepped swiftly down a short ladder and strode rapidly to the house. The 8 guards, each of whom carried a brown leather box, like a motion picture camera, took up unobtrusive positions near at hand. These cases, however, were not used for taking photographs. Billy thought them more like some kind of condensed rapid-fire guns. Before Powart got within earshot, Mona leaned toward Fort.
"This is my fiancé," she said with an evident effort. And when she straightened up, her hands were trembling. Fort took it astonishingly well. He concealed any hint of his feelings as the chairman was introduced. Powart gave him a single penetrating glance, then advanced in his sure, self-confident way, and took both the girl's hands in his own. She remained in her seat.
"I am very glad to see you looking so well. Do you feel truly recovered, Mona?"
"Yes, thank you," coolly. "Or perhaps I should say, thanks to Mr. Fort here."
Powart turned his keen gray eyes upon the athlete.
"If there is any way I can show you how much I appreciate this—"
Fort waved his hand jauntily.
"Wait till I do something that costs me a real effort."
Something in his voice caught the chairman's ear. He scrutinized the athlete more closely, and Billy found herself comparing the two. They were both big fellows, otherwise there was no resemblance. The one was as dark as the other was blonde,
Moreover, he was somewhat heavier than Fort, and of the sort which must be dressed immaculately at all times. His good looks were due to the clean-cut lines of his face, for his eyes were stern, and his mouth very strong. If the one was impulsive, the other was sure. Fort loved to take a chance. The other would not act until he was absolutely certain. Billy decided that he was the steadier, the more reliable of the two. Also, the least likable, for that very reason. Infallibility is a fearsome thing. The mother arose with some remark about going into the gardens, and Fort offered his arm. Powart took their going purely as a matter of course, and continued to stand, he seldom sat down, directly in front of Mona. "I hope," said he in his direct fashion, "that you can see your way clear to consider wearing this." And he produced a small blue velvet case from an inner pocket. And next moment, Billy was peeking over Mona's shoulder, so to speak, to see a ring made of some milk-white metal set with a single oval stone of a blood-red hue. The surgeon gave a tiny gasp at the sight of it. "Bribery and corruption!" she cried, and started to slip the ring onto the middle finger of her left hand. Before it was done, however, she paused. "I almost forgot." She gave Powart a sidelong glance. "Last night I thought it over, and, well, you know how women are about changing their minds." "Surely you haven't completely altered your opinion of me?" Incredulously, rather than anxiously. "No, I just want more time to think it over, that's all. It is not that I think less of you than before, but somehow, since having such a close call, I haven't quite as much confidence in my ability to meet your expectations." This as though she had worded it beforehand. Powart showed little concern. "Of course I am sorry, but perhaps it is just as well. Beyond a doubt you will soon come to see it as clearly as you did the other day." He paused as the girl slowly extended the ring to him. "Why not wear it anyhow, Mona?" "I'd rather not. Not until I am sure. It's a dreadful temptation, though." And Powart had no choice other than to reflect her smile with one of his own, while he quietly slipped the little case back into his pocket. Almost with the same motion, he took out a watch. "You must excuse me. Business of state, as usual." "Certainly," as she rose. She gave a quick glance around, then shook her head playfully as Powart took a single eager step toward her. "Next time," she said, and he bit his lip, gripped her hand tightly, and strode away. In a minute, he and his guards were back in the yacht, and in 3 minutes, out of sight. By that time, Fort and Mona's mother had returned. There was a quick exchange of glances between the two women, and then the mother excused herself and went in the house. Fort suddenly became awkwardly self-conscious. "Well, I must be going." He paused. A gleam of mischief flashed into his eyes, a kind of final comeback. "Next time I rescue you, young lady, I shall let you get hurt ever so much worse, so that I can have an excuse to call more than I have so far." His face sobered swiftly. "I nearly forgot. May I congratulate you upon your engagement? Mr. Powart is a very fine man." "Thank you. So he is. Really, I am lately come to wonder if I am good enough for him." Then significantly, "The date has been postponed indefinitely. It is not impossible that I may give him up." Fort stared incredulously for a second, then saw that she meant it. The blood rushed to his face, leaving him white and shaky with excitement. He made a sudden move toward the girl, checking himself just as suddenly.
Well! His usually easy speech nearly failed him, but he laughed as boldly as ever. I am convinced that you are far from being a well woman, Miss Mona. I shall have to call often. And with a short but exceedingly intense gaze of infinite meaning, he wheeled, clapped his cap to his head, dashed to his machine, and was gone. End of chapter 8.